Hello there, and welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia. I'm Lachlan Peters. So far, in our in-depth explanation of the Khmer Rouge Revolution in Cambodia, we have covered right up until the French colonial period, just before the beginning of the 20th century. This episode is going to focus on the early French colonial era, from the 1870s through to the 1930s and just leading up to the Second World War. We're going to look at what the French presence in Cambodia looked like, how their protectorate functioned, how it changed, and Khmer responses to it. We are also going to have a deep look at the culture of the vast majority of Cambodians during this period when we explore life in the rural villages. We will compare this to the radically different sights and sounds of the steadily modernizing capital of Phnom Penh and revisit the young Saloth Sar as he grows up there in the mid-1930s. This period of Khmer history also sees the early stirrings of Cambodian nationalism, and we will explore how this occurs. You might have noticed that a history show covering the period from 1870 to 1939 may need to explore one or two fairly significant events in world history that occurred during that time. So, in order to accommodate some of these needs, what we're going to do is spend this episode squarely on Cambodian history. That metaphor I used a couple of episodes back, about the massive hurricane or cyclone or typhoon, depending on where you're from. Well, that one that's going to form over Cambodia during the 1970s will rely on those cold, dry winds coming from historical forces and events in Europe, Asia, America, but also the warm, moist winds that will originate within Cambodia itself. This episode will be focused on those warm winds, while the next episode will explore those larger world history themes as both are key to understanding the Cambodian story. But for now, we can return to Cambodia, just when the French have established control over the country, as you'll remember, without firing a shot. At the end of the last episode, we left Cambodia once the French had managed to get King Norodom to sign a treaty that would see the long since powerful kingdom become a protectorate of France. France had conquered the southern part of Vietnam, and during a bit of a lull in action, came over to Cambodia to broker this deal, essentially in their spare time. This meant that the Cambodian court became free of both Siam and Vietnam for the first time in a few generations, and the crown was given to Norodom by the French. What does this all mean, though? What happens when you sign this kind of document? It's not often in the modern world that we see a country change hands. You don't usually see that in the news. Oh, hey, so last night I basically gave our country to a different country. As we discussed, for Cambodia, this initially looked pretty good. They had been getting pretty rough deals from their neighbours basically since the Khmer had left Angkor, and now they had the protection of one of the great European powers to make sure the country would at least stay Khmer and not be completely swallowed up by either Thailand or Vietnam. Now, I've used this term a couple of times now, protectorate. You might be asking what that is. We touched on the definition at the end of the last episode, but it's worth mentioning again that it's not quite the same as a colony. France hadn't conquered Cambodia like it had Cochin China. Cambodia still had local rulers, Norodom was still the king, he still had the power to appoint officials. There were still Khmer regional leaders in the districts and provinces, and they kept their positions. However, as we saw in that ceremony to crown the king, the royal regalia was handed to him by a Frenchman. An imperfect analogy for all this might be like a really big company buying a smaller, struggling, family-owned business. For instance, you've got Mum and Pop's ice cream store. Their business wasn't doing too good. Shop is looking a little shabby, and it looked like they might need to shut down. But then, I don't know, Big Ice Cream comes a knocking one day and says, you know, hey, it's time to sell the property to us. You can keep the name, keep your positions here, but it's probably a good idea to get involved with us now, okay? You know, we've been buying up shops all around town, and we're going to make this a Big Ice Cream kind of suburb. There is just the tiniest impression of a threat as well. Like, if you don't sell the shop to them, they'd get the shop some other way. So you go along. They put down a briefcase full of cash, but they also subtly show that they've got a gun holstered as well. So I don't know, in this pretty heavy-sounding ice cream world that I've painted for you, what do the owners of the little ice cream store do? Well, naturally they take the deal. This way, at least the shop stays the same. No one needs to get fired, the shop can stay open too. We can even keep the same sign out the front. The sign stays the same, but they put that under new management sign, they put that in the window. So now the bigger company owns Mom and Pop's ice cream, and we'll start making a little bit of money off of the top. Every little thing that gets sold, well, a percentage of that, that's coming Big Ice Cream's way. Again, please excuse this less than perfect analogy, but if Cambodia was an investment in this way, what were the French investing in? What's in it for them? Well, first of all, it's not just the financial side. There is also the glory of simply expanding your empire. You know, so you can say something like, we've got ice cream stores in 25 different countries. There is also the idea of the balance of power. You know, like Risk, the board game. That kind of strategy where you want to have territory in some places that means your enemies can't have it. In this case, the French are setting up a little bit of a thorn in the side of Britain's possessions to the west, like in India and Burma. Not to mention this other exciting, explorative aspect to it. Cambodian chronicles were being studied and translated. Angkor was being explored. Sculptures excavated, sent back to museums in Paris. This mysterious and alluring land became a place for adventurers to become entranced by. And then there is the financial side to all this. Remember, the French were very interested in the possibility of using the Mekong River as a means of trading with China, and Phnom Penh would make the perfect base for that. However, once the protectorate is set up and the Mekong is explored, well, they figure out that there's a lot of big waterfalls once you get up into Lao, and the whole thing isn't going to work. Anyway, there are other financial aspects. Basically, in the early days of the French protectorate, Cambodia was less run directly from Paris and more by a handful of young naval officers. Hence the prominence of this exciting adventure angle in all of this. But in the early days, these men are also making money off of business ventures they were setting up or skimming money off the top of. So the scale of French investment in Cambodia was quite small. I'm not particularly business or economically inclined, but from what I gather, there is a lot of red tape and taxes and bureaucratic annoyance to deal with when you are setting up a new business venture, particularly overseas. When Norodom signs that protectorate treaty with France, you can bet that there are some stipulations in there that are going to guarantee the ease of Frenchmen to set up businesses and streamline their ability to make money off of exports. It's worth pointing out how the economic system would have generally worked in pre-colonial Cambodia, so we can see how the French kind of attempt to transplant themselves into the way it was. Basically, the system that had been gradually set up by the Khmer essentially looked like some kind of countrywide pyramid scheme. The government, according to historian David Chandler, meant, and I quote, a network of status relationships and obligations whereby peasants paid in rice, forest products, or labor to support their officials in exchange for protection. These officials then paid the king using some of the rice, forest products, and peasant labor with which they had been paid. Entrepreneurs in the city paid the king for the right to export the products. The number of peasants one could exploit in this way depended on the positions granted by the throne positions that were themselves for sale. Office holders in such a system tended to be members of the elite who had enough money or goods on hand to purchase and protect these positions. End quote. So, the king was at the top, and the royal family. They would sell titles to people who could pay for them, and then, using those titles, set up their own system of dependents, who would pay them in turn for protection, and the bottom rung of this was the local farmer, who would sell whatever he didn't need to survive to a local official as well. And in return, the farmer receives protection from, say, bandits. These patronage networks remain an important facet of society to keep in mind, as it is part of the cultural context that will remain in Cambodian society. This, you could think of it as a kind of web of favours, loans, debts and payments that links the lower strata of society all the way to the top. These strings of patronage will also be one way in which we will discuss the Khmer Rouge and their methods of targeting enemies during the revolution. More on these patronage networks later in the episode. But just returning to the French again, we can see them in these early years just kind of trying to insert themselves into the upper echelons of this pre-established system. If we are talking about mom and pop's ice cream store again, the French have said, okay, how do you run this store? All right, well, you just keep doing that. We're going to set up an office out the back and just keep an eye on things. You keep selling your ice cream however you want to do it and just give us some of the profits at the end of the day. All right? This more, I guess you could say, hands-off system wouldn't last for that long, though. Soon enough, the French would begin enacting reforms that would change protection into control, from protectorate into something far more like a classic colony. In 1884, the French Governor General of Cochin China, Charles Thompson, drove his gunboat up the Mekong and parked it basically right outside the Royal Palace in Phnom Penh. The palace had been moved there from Udong not long after the French established themselves in the country. Now, the reason the Governor General had left his gunboat looking fairly intimidating outside of the palace during his visit to the king is because he was bringing him a new treaty. And just like Lando Calrissian found out in The Empire Strikes Back, the deal he had previously signed off on was about to be altered. Basically, for about 2 decades now, the French had been in Cambodia, and by this time, they had almost completely conquered all of Indochina. What had seemed kind of quaint and exotic when they first arrived now seemed backward and oppressive. And even though they had originally gone after Norodom, prized him away from the Siamese bosom, and signed that original treaty of protection with him, they had started thinking that maybe he was getting in the way of making this protectorate into an actual worthwhile investment. If we bring back this to the mom and pop store takeover, well, this is like those guys from Big Ice Cream finally going over the four quarters figures, looking at some of the books and going, these guys might actually really suck at selling ice cream. They look a little bit deeper, maybe have a look at some of the store's inventory. Turns out mom and pop get all of their ingredients from the most dodgy places in town. They get the choc chips from a place that still uses child labour, and they buy all their ice cream from a farm where they routinely kick the cows. Not only is Big Ice Cream not making money out of this investment, so, the whole reason they bought it isn't looking sustainable, but also they're realising that mom and pop store isn't run according to the ethical guidelines of a big corporation like themselves. Now in the Cambodian case, the investors, well, they were French, the land of liberté, equalité and fraternité. Because large sections of Cambodia still relied on a system of slavery or indentured servitude, those hierarchies and pyramids of dependency that the French were siphoning off profits from would be considered in modern parlance to be problematic. It was bad enough that they had a colonial empire and that there were people back in Paris pointing out the hypocrisy of this, let alone the fact that this investment and protection of Cambodia wasn't making enough money. So Governor General Thompson, he turns up at the Royal Palace to meet up with Norodom. He does this at the not too subtle hour of 10 p.m, and he brings with him two armed bodyguards, and the equivalent of a floating tank. He has the treaty with him, and Norodom knows that if he doesn't sign it and go along with whatever reforms may be within it, including the abolition of slavery, then the French are just going to give the crown to his half-brother Sisowath, who has been angling to become king for years. So the fact that this new treaty would include less slavery in Cambodia is a pretty good thing, right? Well, it depends on who you ask. For starters, we've already talked about the slightly cynical reason that it was included within the treaty. Basically, if you're in Parliament back in Paris and someone says, hey, how come we've turned Cambodia from a protectorate into something looking a hell of a lot like a colony? Well, you can rebut that with, well, we had to tighten our control there. In fact, we've just gotten rid of slavery. Would you prefer there to be more slaves in Cambodia? And, you know, while you've shut that guy with a dissenting voice up, you can focus on setting up more strict and efficient financial structures in the country to start getting more of a return on your investment there. So that's the French perspective. But what about the Khmer? Did they welcome this change? Not at all. As we discussed, these patronage networks, these pyramids, or a better way to think of it might be like bonds tied by strings, or in Khmer, ksai. These are hardwired into Cambodian society. Even today, it's fairly easy to notice these hierarchies, whether in government or within the general public. Practically anyone with even a degree of authority has a string of people dependent on them, that he or she is also dependent on, and that they exchange loyalty or other services for in order to remain within that person's network of power. These go up and down and throughout the country, and it wouldn't be too surprising to have a similar 6 degrees of separation between you and Kevin Bacon thing going on, but between most people in Cambodia and someone close to the top of the country, with a system of loyalty and power hierarchy going on between each step in the equation. But how does that relate back to slavery? Well, the reforms that the French included were aimed at, for lack of a better word, proper slavery. The kind of horrible slavery that the word conjures. But these reforms would have also affected slavery light, spelt L-I-T-E. Like, if I come from a family with 9 kids, and my parents needed to pay off a debt with someone higher in their patronage string, they might have made me go and work for that person on their farm, and living with them in their village. This, I mean, it's not great, pretty feudal, which makes sense given Cambodia's development at this time, but it was part of the system in place, it was part of society. So naturally, if that kind of slavery were abolished, it would disrupt these patronage strings, and would very soon impact the Cambodian elite who were in control of the lower rungs of power in the country. Remember, you purchase your positions and you have to keep paying for them. If that process is hindered, well, everyone's got a problem. It blocks the flow of society, as you could imagine someone saying who sat in one of those more privileged positions. This impact was not exactly just a nice humane coincidence of the French treaty either. The French knew that if they wanted more power in the country, they would have to begin wrestling it off some of these high-level officials who controlled most of the countryside and the people in it. Certainly a more realistic factor as to why the French were getting behind such a noble cause. So what happens after this treaty is signed and the attendant changes are enacted? Just a nationwide rebellion. The rebellion started in 1885 and had several leaders. It broke out in different locations around the country. Local rebel leaders were able to gather support at the village level, and it would go on for almost a year and a half. Eventually, it would need to be quelled by around 4,000 French and Vietnamese troops. As a result, the French had to hold back some of those reforms in the treaty, including the total abolition of slavery and a new system where local officials would have to have a French equivalent that watched over what they did, called a resident, or I guess I should say the French, résident. The treaty itself was still signed and ratified by Norodom, but the reforms themselves wouldn't be initiated for a few more decades. And what can we learn from this? Well, local officials were still able to drum up support quite quickly if need be, like they had done against the Vietnamese in the 1840s. But also, perhaps the quiet, simple and smiling Khmer weren't quite as docile as the French had originally assumed. The treaty itself, though, this signalled a general change in direction for the Protectorate, towards securing French interests as the most important goal. The Cambodian people, or Cambodia's position in relation to its neighbours, was less of a concern than just trying to organise the country in a more efficient way, a way that was simply aimed at making more money for the French. Remember, the 1880s was also the time that France consolidated power all over Indochina, including northern Vietnam and Laos. The new structure of French Cambodia, and French Indochina, would be achieved by inserting more French power and bureaucracy into the country. The résidences that we referred to earlier would eventually be placed into the provinces all around the country and make sure that each district was lined up accordingly so that the taxes and goods could be procured from each with less Khmer influence. These residents then answered to the résident supérieur, who lived in Phnom Penh, and he was responsible for reporting to the Governor-General of all of Indochina. Now, while these changes could be more easily initiated in and around Phnom Penh or the larger towns and provinces, in general, many parts of the countryside remained somewhat outside of French knowledge and reach. A little bit how in some video games, where you've got that kind of fog that obscures a view of your map, with the places unexplored remaining grey. David Chandler contends in his A History of Cambodia that in this period, no one knew how many people it contained, what they thought, or who held titles to land. Although slavery had been abolished, servitude for debts, often lasting a lifetime, remained widespread. At the village level, things probably looked the same as they had for centuries. Because this rebellion occurred under the rule of King Norodom, the French tacitly blamed him for letting it happen. As well as the reforms in taxes and the greater degree of control that the colonial power initiated at more levels of Cambodian society, the French also sought to give the next title of king to someone other than Norodom's sons. This seemingly mundane decision is worth planting a flag on, however, as shifting the royal succession here will eventually lead to one of the most important characters of this story, Norodom Sihanouk, eventually being crowned in roughly half a century. One really obvious example of how this period highlights a change between protectorate and what functions politically and economically more like a colony can be seen in the treatment of Norodom. He was a full-on opium addict, and the French didn't hesitate in feeding this addiction, delivering him beautifully ornate wooden boxes of what I would assume to be very high-grade content. As the king's health deteriorated, they took no time in removing his executive authority, placing these powers in the hands of a Frenchman. In the words of David Chandler, these abusive and impatient French officials, they had fortunes to be made, and Norodom seemed to be standing in the way of all of this. As the king's health reached a low point in 1897, the French promised Sisowa, Norodom's half-brother, the throne. However, it would take another 7 years before the first modern king of Cambodia, the man that had signed that first treaty establishing this protectorate, to pass away in 1904. When he died and Sisowa was given reign, was another first in Cambodian history, as the French, and the French alone, decided who was going to be the next king. To those Khmer that held positions of authority around the country, they could easily sense that the power had completely shifted to the French, and that the idea of Cambodian interests being put before those of the French was a mere facade. Sisowa, once installed, was probably a bit more of a popular king than Norodom, and he took to the puppet aspect of this quite well. He posed as a king. He engaged in all the appropriate ceremonies that a Cambodian king must do. He also took after his brother in enjoying the very kind allowance of extremely high-grade opium that the French delivered him annually. More than 113 kilograms, apparently. This, I can only imagine, would really take the edge off of some of the more stressful aspects of royal life, you know, with the palace, the wives, concubines, the quasi-godlike power, you know, the tough life. And that does pretty well to introduce us to Cambodia here at the start of the 20th century. The king is visible, he is popular, but the real control is completely in the hands of a foreign power. Life for most Khmer basically stayed the same, despite some of the advancements that were being seen closer to the capital city. Slowly, a degree of functioning electricity and water services could be seen. The modernization toward the edges of the kingdom were far off, however. Communication inside Cambodia remained very poor, and the only segment of that society which was being modernized was dominated by the French and was aimed more toward the immigrants from China and Vietnam, who ran the businesses, as well as holding most of the bureaucratic functions within Phnom Penh. To illustrate this disparity, I think it is Chandler who juxtaposes technologies like cars, electricity, and running water to people's lives in the rural villages, where an ex-monk gathered a following by claiming to possess a golden frog with a human voice. So people in the countryside were essentially still living in a feudal system, where their labour and rice was being funneled up the patronage strings and pyramids to the upper echelons in Phnom Penh in order to fund the development of this increasingly modern city. The branches of government that a Cambodian peasant might encounter in these years was composed of a minority of Cambodians and of a great many Vietnamese who were brought into the protectorate because they could prepare reports in French. And this interplay between Cambodians and Vietnamese had important effects on the development of Cambodian nationalism, particularly after World War II, which we will see in later episodes, but also explore toward the end of this one. In this period, Sisawat went on a kind of tour of France, and in 1906, a deal was brokered between the French and Siam, where the provinces of Battambang and Siem Reap were given back to Cambodia. Now, if you recall, these two areas were used as bargaining chips by the French in trying to persuade Siam to just let Cambodia become of the French protectorate. So it's nice that they got those back, and the Khmer themselves were naturally very happy to get back such important areas of their country. Siem Reap contains Angkor, and the French effort to restore and protect many of the temples there began soon after, which may be one of the best things they do during their time in Cambodia. In the years after this, there is relatively little to report, only a few minor examples of dissatisfaction with French rule, as the majority of Khmer just carried on living their lives in the countryside, as Phnom Penh became the focal point of French modernization and rule. However, in 1916, a kind of protest by the peasantry requires some attention. This during, and perhaps a result of, French involvement in the First World War. The war, as in the fighting of this war, did not have much of an impact on Cambodia. Around 2,000 to 2,500 Cambodians would be enlisted to fight for France. But compare this to more than the 30,000 that would be provided by the Vietnamese, and you can readily see the difference. Many served as garrison troops in France and Macedonia, but others saw action in Vietnamese-Cambodian frontline units on the Western Front, in places like the Somme. Very little is known about who joined up or why, whether it was out of devotion to the protectorate, or perhaps just a spirit of adventure that many other young men felt and subsequently joined up because of, in what would prove to be an immense waste of life. We won't spend much time on the First World War, as it is a little outside of what we need to be learning about in this episode, and there are other, more hardcore, places that this information could be better found. We will not ignore it completely, however, and it would be worth at least noting some of the themes of this podcast that are highlighted by some of the factors leading to the world's first truly global conflict. Colonialism being one. European powers spread around the globe and the eventual rising tension of wanting more territory for one's own empire at the expense of another. The changes in European power politics following the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars. And of course, nationalism. That raw power that can be harnessed within a population to great and devastating effect. We discussed this last episode in the French Revolution. There I made the analogy between using something like coal for electricity and the pretty extreme effect this will end up having on, say, nature. Well, the First World War is a pretty good example of that nationalistic energy turning into a full-on disaster. More than 10 million people will die in the 4 years that the conflict takes place over, not to mention setting up many of the darker events of the 20th century. And while it is certainly too simplistic to point to nationalism by itself as the cause of this human tragedy, it is worth pointing out the way in which this war will be welcomed by the people of Europe. Almost jubilantly will young men, encouraged by young women, join up in droves to fight this glorious nationalistic cause. This is that political energy at work. This is the coal on the fire, and the results are death. Some of the other effects of this war and its causes will be discussed in the next episode, with the long beginnings of the Cold War, and we will return to some of those cold, dry winds and their role in the eventual hurricane that is going to form over Cambodia later. I guess the other thing to note here is that World War I, with its staggering cost of human life, will usher in the new century in a dark, malodorous, and foreboding fashion. The century of death had begun, and Cambodia will eventually make a sizable contribution to it. Certain fundamentals of the 20th century are put in place here. The end of European hegemony, in particular the devastating effect on France, but also the rise of the US as a superpower, the Soviet Revolution in 1917, and the depressing way the stage is set for the Second World War. But for now, World War I and Cambodia. Apart from those who go and serve and see parts of the world that few Khmer had dreamt of before this, there is relatively little effect. Apart from an event that occurred as a consequence of higher taxation from the French as they sought to bolster their efforts on the Western Front. When these efforts filtered down to the peasants in the villages, a kind of small-scale, not revolt, more like a protest occurred, where thousands of Khmer, over a few weeks, would march into Phnom Penh and demand that Sisawat do something about these increased taxes. It's not a huge deal, but in this era where we have few things to talk about in reference to the actual Khmer people, it needs mentioning. Also because it was another example to the French that their racist attitudes about the Cambodians weren't completely correct. They were able to mobilize themselves rather quickly and demonstrate their discontent if they needed, rather than just assuming the docile, timeless role that the French had ascribed to them. In general, however, apart from this mass petitioning of the king, the motives of which, whether they were anti-French or simply an appeal to the king for justice, are not exactly clear. Apart from this event, known as the 1916 affair, the period between then and the mid-1920s was relatively peaceful, uneventful, and one of increasing prosperity in Cambodia, according to David Chandler. What we do start to notice in this period, or what can be illustrated quite well, is the sense of distance between the French and the Khmer. Whether it was a protectorate or a colony, the average Khmer was far removed from not only the French themselves, but also the modernity that the French were bringing to minuscule areas of the country. That was supposed to be part of the French mission in Cambodia. Protection, bringing Cambodia into the modern world. But because what they were supposed to be doing was scarcely taking place, the French took refuge in the idea that the Khmer were somehow innately resistant to modernity, that they were this timeless people, immune to change, stereotypically lazy and corrupt. We can point to a few things in the 1920s that illustrate this, like how fewer and fewer French officials were bothering to learn Khmer, or the fact that the French spent almost nothing on Cambodian education. There was barely a handful of schools, and even primary education was a rarity. Medical services were minute. Electricity and running water, as we've seen, was practically unheard of outside of Phnom Penh. What makes these facets of French rule not just unhelpful to the Khmer, but more toward that category of outright negligence, was how much your average Khmer person was paying for this so-called protectorate. And I'm rubbing my fingers together doing the finger thing. It's time to talk about taxes. As we saw during the French Revolution, heavy taxation on a large peasant population can have some interesting effects in the long term. And there was a staggering disparity between what your average farmer in the countryside was paying in taxes in comparison to the French officials in Phnom Penh. In 1885, the French introduced a unit of currency for Indochina that would increase monetary stability. It was called the piastre de commerce. Your average French official could make around 12,000 piastres a year, and perhaps pay only about 30 piastres in tax in that same year. A Cambodian farmer, though, they could make about 90 piastres a year if they were working. If they were just selling crops, you're probably making less than about 40 piastres a year. Yet they were saddled with taxes of around 12 piastres a year in the 1920s. So for your farmer, that's more than a quarter of your extremely limited income. To speed the maths here, that's about 100 times the rate that your far more wealthy monsieur is going to pay. As we've seen, most of this money is just going to the capital, where it's going into the pockets of French officials, the royals and the elite, and for projects that they deemed worthy of financial backing, rather than something like, I don't know, primary education. Cambodia was being protected, sure. Siam, Vietnam, they're out of the picture. And the Khmer are going to survive. The 19th century was not going to repeat itself. But the 20th century, this was also being kept at bay. So while we're on the topic of ludicrous taxation of a peasant base, like when it's some kind of cliche Brothers Grimm fairy tale, there is one event in particular that occurs on the 18th of April, 1925, that we really must bring up. It occurs in Krang Li village, about 100 kilometers northwest of Phnom Penh. Although the name of the village would be changed by this event to a particularly offensive word in the Khmer language, Derichan, which translates to bestial. On that hot afternoon in the Cambodian summer, the resident, or resident, of Kampong Chhnang province, Felix Louis Bardes, a 33-year-old civil servant who had spent the last 15 years of his life in Cambodia, he was driving out to this village off of the main road to collect on delinquent taxes. Bardes was a hard worker, an example of the new structures that the French had put in place in order to maximize returns on their investment in Cambodia. He'd built a reputation for himself over the last 3 years. He was very efficient and believed that if he himself worked harder and tried to personally fix some of the issues that lower-level Cambodian officials were creating, like when they went into a village to produce numbers and procure the taxes on the landholdings, as well as try and limit some of the corruption that was occurring between this level and the string of officials which actually collected that revenue. Bardez believed that he could make this whole process more productive if he supervised it quite closely and intervened when necessary. I guess you could call him hands-on in his approach. He'd been promoted from a similar position in Preiving province in the southeast because he was able to gain a higher yield in tax revenue by exposing the compromises, the doctored books, and exaggerations that were taking place at village level by these local Khmer officials. This plays into that idea we were discussing about the French. They were attempting to disrupt and replace the traditional patronage strings that had served as a foundation of the Cambodian economy, replacing them with French bureaucrats that could squeeze more money out in order to fund the colony itself and produce more capital for France. Because of the excellent work he'd done in Preiving, he was given another, more important province, which needed tightening up. In the days and weeks leading up to his trip to the village, Bardez had written in his diary and explained to his friends that there really wasn't that much money in the village to meet the demands that had been imposed. Recently, a new mountain resort for the elites and royal family had been built at Bokor, just near the town of Kampot, which is a popular tourist destination today. And like other projects of the French and royals, naturally the price in money and labour was passed down to the lowest levels of society to pay. A red line was marked under the town of Krang Liev. They hadn't paid up yet. Despite his reservations, however, feeling as though they may not really be able to produce the money, Bardez certainly didn't get that recent promotion by not achieving his targets, and he was a young, ambitious official. Perhaps the difficulties he thought may occur explains the reason why he did not drive to the village alone. He brought two Khmer with him, an interpreter to get his point across, as well as an armed security officer. So, even though this official had spent more than a decade in Cambodia, he couldn't speak Khmer, highlighting how French officials in their protectorate functioned in a somewhat removed space from the populace. He would communicate his need for the taxes to be paid from French into Khmer, and with the threat of force in the background. Upon disembarking his vehicle and gathering everyone in the village, he demanded through the interpreter that the group of delinquent taxpayers come forth. Then he shackled them and put them in a local hall. He also instructed his guard to beat them, and he himself may have done the same. What makes the patronizing actions of this ambitious resident harder to swallow is that there was a law in place that was simply given the several people in the village who hadn't paid the taxes a fine for not doing so. A fine which would have been incurred 3 months after the payments were due. Yet Bardez had decided to shackle them up in a hall in the middle of summer and declare that they would go to prison if they didn't pay up. An impasse followed. And this is when a crowd of villagers came to witness the spectacle that had begun to unfold. The mood became particularly sour when, after what must have dragged on long enough to produce an appetite in the French official, he retrieved his lunch and began eating, refusing to let his new prisoners do the same. Perhaps Bardez was banking on the stereotypes that had grown within the French conscience about the Khmer as peaceable, smiling, simple folk who couldn't muster anything against a European like himself. Or maybe he was trying his hand at intimidation tactics that were a level he was unaccustomed to administering in person. Whatever it may have been, his actions in Krang Liev that afternoon, in the hot sun, waiting for their friends and families to be released, and offended by the complete lack of respect and overly harsh treatment that was being meted out, well, they snapped. More recent accounts of that afternoon state that an argument occurred between Bardez and the wife of one of the prisoners. Her name was Bi, and she was the best hat maker in the village. She had already paid the 5 piastres that were owing, but Bardez said that her husband wouldn't be freed until all the rest of them had paid as well. She grew angry and lashed out, saying, "Do you treat us Khmer people like humans or the trash at your feet?" In response, Bardez allegedly told his security guard, a man named Lak, to shoot this woman. That is when another villager ran and attacked the guard before he could carry this order out, which allowed Bi to run at Bardez and hit him with an iron bar that she found near the door of the hall. It's not completely clear whether this was completely impromptu or that there may have been a plan circulating around the crowd for a while, but it was hastily put into action, and a group of 20 to 30 of the villagers rushed at Bardez, his interpreter, and the armed guard. They beat them to death with chairs, fence posts, axe handles, and eventually the guard's own rifle butt, beaten to their last breath before being stabbed repeatedly with daggers. The corpses were then mutilated, and according to some who were there, the group of murderers danced around the bodies. This impromptu protest was then gathered into a crowd by some local leaders, and they marched toward the provincial capital to demand lower taxes. But eventually the crowd kind of dissolved. Over the subsequent few weeks, one suspect was given a death sentence, 5 others life imprisonment, and 13 other sentences were given out, ranging from a few months to 15 years in prison. And it was then that King Sisowat issued the brand on that village that is still felt into the present day, renaming the village Bestial, while also mandating that a stupa for Bardez be built to highlight the humiliation of the town. In a Phnom Penh Post article written in 2018, the grandson of Sam Yom, one of the delinquent taxpayers shackled on that afternoon, says that even in the 1960s, when he was going to school, there was still teasing. People saying, "Ah, Derichan, you beast." And that the residents of the village were not allowed to move elsewhere. He recalled his grandfather saying, "We were humans, not animals. What Bardez did to us at that time was unbearable. But instead, we were blamed for killing a bad guy. This is a lesson of what it was like when a country is ruled by another." Chandler states that this incident exposed the mechanics of colonial rule and the unreality of French mythology about the Cambodian character. Quote, "It is as if a great deal of Cambodian life in the colonial period was carried out behind a screen, invisible and inaudible to the French." End quote. Now, for a while, we've been talking about French rule and what kings have been doing, about revolutions in other countries. But now we've finally been able to discuss the Khmer in our story, and genuinely see and hear from them, from people, like the man who was held captive by Bardez that day, and saying that this is a lesson of what it is like when a country is ruled by another, implying that there is some kind of energy that was produced and that violently erupted that afternoon in a kind of microcosm of French colonial rule in Cambodia. The reason I've shared this story, and why it is often highlighted in the literature on Cambodia, is because over the next couple of decades, we will see this event as perhaps one of the precursors to a Cambodian nationalism that will grow within this context of colonialism. This kind of reaction to the French, or some of the early stirrings of an independence movement, will become the focus of episodes down the track, and we will look at the development of this in the 1930s toward the end of this episode. Going forward, however, I want to keep our story firmly within the world of the Khmer. I want to give you a look at life behind that screen that the French were not perceiving. I want to give you an impression of what this rural life was, what life looked like for the vast majority of Khmer in Cambodia during this period, and indeed centuries before this and decades after. We haven't been able to do this since Chau Tu Khan's Customs of Cambodia in episode 3. And I need to highlight the importance of certain fundamental aspects of this way of life, not only because it provides quite a contrast between the old world and the modern one that is being built in Phnom Penh at the hands of the French, but because eventually Pol Pot and the Communist Party of Kampuchea are going to force everyone back into, you could say a kind of version of this world again, but it won't be the same. It will be deformed. It will be a brutalized version of this world. It is a perfect time to give you at least an impression of this world before it is tainted by the Khmer Rouge. Because even though this rural lifestyle will be held up and idealized by the eventual communist revolutionaries, fundamental aspects of this old people lifestyle will also be smashed to pieces. What is this life in the countryside that we've been calling, at times, feudal, peasantry, unchanging? What is it about the space that the majority of the Khmer are living in that begs these kinds of descriptions? It's at this point in the podcast that I can finally spend some time talking about the unseen Khmer in the story. We've gone through almost 2,000 years of history here, and we've not been able to, as yet, truly connect with the lives of the people who live this story. So, we're going to talk about what it's like living as a Khmer in the countryside. And this will be an important facet of the story later. Not just because the cities will be emptied and the infamous designations of new people and old people will be so clearly defined by this relationship to the old, rural way of living, but because when you study any kind of period of mass death, various cultural markers will distinguish various aspects of that period. This rural lifestyle will give us some context to those eventual discussions. But also, many of you may be listening to find out more about this country and people without explicit reference to the tragedy and nightmare of the 1970s. So with that in mind, I want to tell you about life rather than death in this part of Cambodia. As we are still somewhere in the middle of the 1920s on this path through our story, I'm going to have to cheat slightly when finding a source for all of this information. One of the best, one of the few, studies of life in the villages was not written until the 1960s, when May Ebihara, an anthropology student from Columbia University, would write her PhD, Svay, a Khmer Village in Cambodia, and provide us with an in-depth look into this world. Now, while the source I'm using was not written in the 20s, the world she was describing was more or less the same as it would have been in that time period, with a few exceptions. So with that in mind, we're just going to go through some of the basics here, so we can get an understanding on what it's like to be Khmer. Some of the context that is going to be so important when we discuss how the revolution will break some of the most fundamental aspects of life, not only for the people living in the cities, but also in the villages. So, just to introduce her study slightly, May Ebihara's contribution to the study of Cambodia shouldn't be understated, as her year-long visit in Svay from 1959 to 1960 was one of the only anthropological studies undertaken in rural Cambodia before the Vietnam War, as well as the coup against Sihanouk and the Cambodian Civil War, and obviously before the Khmer Rouge's devastating revolution. It is invaluable to those looking to gain a sense of Cambodian society that is unmolested by some of these large-scale historical events. Her goal, according to her PhD, was to, quote, study a lowland rice-growing Khmer village because the Khmer comprise the dominant part of the nation's population, and rice production occupies the majority of the peasantry. She goes on to explain that she chose Sfey as the location to conduct this study because in many ways it was extremely typical. There were not large sections of other ethnic groups within it, like Chinese, Cham or Vietnamese. And she says that of course not every village in Cambodia is the same, but the 800 people that live in Sfey give a fair representation of that kind of village. One focused on rice production, one that was predominantly Khmer, and one that wasn't too affected by a regional or provincial capital. The village that she chose is about 30 kilometers south-southwest of Phnom Penh. And while we're talking about locations and geography like this, I also figured this would be a good time for us to get back our mental map, or a real map, and just kind of go over some of these locations, go over what Cambodia looks like again. At this stage in our story, the lines on the map are essentially the same as they will be going forward, so we can start getting our footing as to where what is and which region is where. I'll put a map in the description so you can follow along with me if you would like, and I'll just give you a little bit of time to do that now. Alrighty, so clockwise from the western provinces, we will start with Battambang, Siem Reap, the districts that changed hands from Siam back to Cambodia in 1906. We've spent a fair bit of time here in the podcast so far. As I said, Siem Reap contains the noticeably large Great Lake, the Tonle Sap, as well as the region of Angkor and the ancient cities of Yasodharapura and Mahendrapravada, the old seat of the Khmer Empire and its predecessor. To the east, we have Kampong Tong, a large province which also borders the Tonle Sap. Kampong means port, and Tom means great or large. This province contains the village of Prex Bao, which we spoke about at the start of the last episode. Moving further around the clock, we've got Stung Treng and Kracher, which border the more forested and mountainous regions of Ratanakiri and Mondulkiri, themselves bordering Laos and Vietnam. These two provinces are also populated by some of Cambodia's minority ethnicities and tribal peoples, like the Jerai and the Khoi. Coming back around, we've got Kampong Cham, Port of the Chams. Remember, that's the Muslim ethnic group that came from the old Kingdom of Champa, then toward the border with southern Vietnam, or at the time we're talking about in the story, Cochin China. We have Prey Veng and Sve Veng, Phnom Penh sitting there in its own kind of central district in the middle there, at the confluence of the Mekong and the Tonle Sap River. And then further down you can see Takeo, Kampot, and then the provinces of Kampong Som and Koh Kong, where you'd head these days for a slightly more tropical, coastal kind of visit. Now, if you've spent that time just trying to get that last picture of Cambodia up, you can also look, if you'd like, at the other link I've placed in the description of this episode, and you're going to be brought to a Google Street View of what I would term as another kind of typical slice of Cambodia, particularly this kind of rural area that you see a lot of, and what we can begin imagining life to be lived in. I chose this area, which is a bit out of the way, just because the actual village of Sfey looks a little bit more modern now than it did, I don't know, 70 years ago. If you're looking at it now, you can see the paddies, the huge blue sky, the colours, the palm trees in the distance. It looks like these images were captured in April as well, which is the hotter end of the dry season, just before the reprieve of the rainy season generally falls in the month of May. So we're getting the brown version of Cambodia, as opposed to the green one. For me, these kinds of pictures evoke a real feel for Cambodia, or at least a part of it. And if you want to have a look around to try and get in that feeling within Google, well then please be my guest. If you're currently on a bus, traveling on one of these roads, feel free to have a look around. Anyway, historian Philip Short describes Cambodian life as having an earthy, elemental quality, and it comes across in Ebihara's description of life in Sfey as well. The Khmer who are firmly inhabiting this earthy element, this way of life, could be designated at this time in our story to be within the lower class of Cambodia. We're going to discuss class and class distinctions more as we discuss communist theories of history in the next episode, but for now, we're going to crudely delineate three different strata of Cambodian society. We've got the royals, aristocracy, high-ranking government officials, very wealthy Khmer or Chinese Cambodian businessmen, as well as the French officials and general colonial population. They're up here at the top. The lowest is the Cambodian rural peasantry. In between both of these is a kind of intermediate class that doesn't really fall within these two more obvious groupings. Like smaller businessmen, merchants, professionals like teachers and doctors, people in the middle or lower ranks of government as well. If we're talking about the 20s, these distinctions are probably less developed and far more unlikely to be inhabited by Cambodians in this time as well. But they will become more apparent in the period leading up to and after the Second World War, and certainly up to the Cambodian Civil War. You might have also noticed a lack of a general worker class in there, like factory employees. They're not in that distinction. Now, this is mainly due to the French having kept Cambodia as an agricultural economy and not encouraging industrialization in the country. Why? Well, one reason was so that the French goods produced at home by their industrialized methods could instead be sold to Cambodia rather than produced within it. Again, the reason I'm mentioning this will make more sense when we discuss communism in later episodes, but for now, for a more simplified version of these class structures, in this episode, and particularly in this time period, it might be easier just to divide those that live in the urban areas and the Cambodians that live in the rural villages. Those that live in rural areas could be defined as subsistence farmers, and is the nature of this lifestyle that we want to explore here. Naturally, if your life is classified in such a way as a subsistence farmer, then perhaps the best place to start if we're going to describe that life or talk about that life in Sve, well, let's start with farming. This is the fundamental goal of that life. And it's been a while, but it's time to talk about rice again. We haven't talked about this delicious, nutritious, and fragrant gift from the universe, rice, since maybe the first episode on the Khmer Empire. But we do need to get back to it here if we're going to discuss the life of modern Cambodians too. Now, if you're like me and live fairly removed from the actual world of agriculture and just buy this stuff in handy bags, well, maybe you also don't quite know just what it is. The actual thing you buy, boil, and eat is the seed of the grass species Oryza sativa. That's the name for the Asian variety anyway. Ebihara noted that, in the village of Svai, the term for eating a meal in Khmer, Nyambai, was literally to eat rice. And hunger? Well, that's expressed to be hungry for rice, Klingbai. And that's really no surprise considering that it's the basic component of every meal. Rice gruel served at breakfast and boiled rice for the evening meal. Sweets and cakes are also made from rice grown for that purpose in particular. An adult in this period was estimated to eat between 15 to 22 kilograms of rice per month, and apparently in the village of Svai, the Khmer could list more than 25 varieties of rice, each with certain distinctions of form or taste with different names that denote different qualities. It could also be used as a substitute for money, as many inhabitants generally wouldn't have had much cash on hand. So, it's a fundamental aspect of life. To quote Ebihara, it is not only the principal activity, but equally the most ancient traditional activity. Rice production occupies about 80% of all cultivated lands in Cambodia during this time, and it's primarily grown in wet paddies in the lowlands of the country. The majority is grown by farmers, and as we've said, primarily for consumption, i.e. subsistence, with only occasional or limited surplus being sold on at the market. This means you are basically going to grow enough to feed you and your family. And if it's a great season, well then maybe you'll have a little extra to be able to sell for a small amount of money. For most Cambodians in the countryside, because they didn't have much land, they could never get that much of a surplus, which kind of limits your maneuverability economically. That being said, some regions in the country with a relatively low population and large per capita land holdings could produce substantial amounts of rice for both regional and international trade, leading to a reputation for Cambodia as one of the rice baskets of Southeast Asia. The main kind of rice grown is floating rice, which is sown and cultivated during the rainy season and requires irrigation from floodwaters and water that can be collected during that period of heavy rainfall that covers May through to November. In the village of Sveh, each rice field is owned by individual families, except in the rare case where a married couple might jointly purchase a paddy with another couple. Each paddy is worked by the whole family as well, and generally a paddy is acquired through inheritance. These parts of your land, these paddies, are parceled up and separated by little earthen dikes. If you've ever been to Cambodia, or even looking at that image on Google Maps that I shared earlier, you'll notice this basic setup quite clearly. And from above, you can imagine the grid-like pattern of all these paddies across the landscape. The annual cycle of rice cultivation generally begins when the rainy season starts, and when water brings back life to the dry, desiccated soil. Ponds and water jars are replenished, and when the dirt is soft enough to be worked in again, the rice season begins. The rhythm of life is dictated here by the rain and the rice. The harvest will eventually be stored half a year later and sustain life during the dry season, which is something these Khmer share with their distant ancestors, as we saw during the time of Angkor. Tying the king into this lifestyle, well, traditionally the ploughing of the fields to begin preparing the paddies, well, that won't begin until after the royal ceremony of the sacred plough. Generally, this occurs sometime in May, where the king will go through the motions of ploughing a paddy, offerings are made, and mystic predictions of the harvest and well-being of the kingdom occur. This doesn't happen everywhere though, and many villagers are just prompted to begin the agricultural cycle by the climate rather than the ritual. Once the paddies have been ploughed and the dikes that separate them have been rebuilt from the last season, the rice seed is sown. And just to point out again that this rice seed is the same rice that's also grown, then eaten, then stored, and then planted at the end and start of the process. So if one family needs to eat up their reserve during the dry season, well, they may need to borrow or buy more rice for growing at the start of the next cycle. And if we just think ahead slightly there and pop that up a couple of scales, well, if the whole country eats into its rice reserve and there's not enough left for the sowing of the seed in the next season, well, then you're looking at something like starvation. An outcome we will explore during the Khmer Rouge regime. Anyway, once the rainy season has begun, seedlings of rice are pulled from nursery paddies and transplanted into the larger growing paddies. If you've travelled through the region during this season, or even if you're familiar with just imagery from Asia, you might recognize the picture of women with bundles of rice stems in hand, bent over and plunging seedlings into the muddy paddy. This work is generally undertaken by women, Ebihara noting that the older women, with their years of practice, tend to zoom ahead of their younger, adolescent girls who are just learning this skill, and they are playfully teased by their mothers and aunties. The rice is sown in lines while they sing and laugh in what can be quite arduous work, particularly in the sun. Because of this, numerous breaks are taken in the shade or on the dikes, where people might have a snack, some water. Once this part of the harvest is complete, the villagers enjoy a period of relative leisure until the major harvest of the rice in November and December. In this time, some men might leave the village to get some work elsewhere, make a little more money for their families until it's time to harvest. During this period, the countryside becomes a beautiful tapestry of shades of green as the rice grows, compared to the drab grey and brown of the dry season in particular. Belief in spirits, such as the Nik Ta, or the Buddha, can also lead villagers to make offerings or pray in this time to alleviate concerns about a poor harvest or the potential for insufficient rain. Again, we haven't spoken about the Nikta in a while, but they are an important aspect of Khmer culture and can be generally considered kinds of guardian spirits, but the designation can be given to a variety of supernatural entities, from animistic spirits to celestial deities. Harmless if given proper deference, but can bring illness or trouble if ignored or treated disrespectfully. This folk religion is generally blended with the Theravada beliefs and even some remnants of the old Hindu ones that originally came over from India. Ebihara noted that the villager rarely conceives of observing separate religious traditions. Rather, for the ordinary Khmer, Buddha and ghosts, prayers at the temple and invocations to spirits, monks and mediums, all this spirituality is part of what is essentially a single religious system, where different aspects are called into play at different appropriate times. Buddhist holidays, along with the stages of the annual rice harvest, are the main markers of the life cycle in the village. But the intricacies of Theravada theology and doctrine are little known to the average villager. But basic notions are well known from sermons at the temple that might relate aspects of the Buddha's life or some of the main precepts. The average layman has little hope of achieving nirvana and is unlikely to say, meditate. But something more easily grasped might be a better existence in the next life simply by accomplishing enough good deeds in this lifetime, proceeding along a righteous path. One way of doing this is actually to become a monk, which is done by many Cambodian males for at least some period of their lives. It is not like some Christian notions where the idea of being a priest is like a lifelong career. For the Khmer, someone can come in and devote themselves to this way of life for a few months or years, and then return to their regular life, and it's simple enough. Some precepts of Buddhism are taken more seriously than others, in a way that many religions are generally followed. Say, the precept against killing, well, that's taken very strongly, where the slaughter of animals is abhorred and generally delegated to Cham or Chinese butchers. However, certain creatures such as crabs, snakes, insects, or fish are dispatched quite readily by the villagers, Ebihara noting that chickens were sometimes a borderline case. She also said that the precept against drinking alcohol is followed, but one's back can be easily turned on this one, and relaxing with beer or wine when money is available or on holidays is generally fine. But excessive drunkenness is abhorred and considered evidence of a bad character. The Buddhist temple, or wat, is a center of social life, with many festivals and holidays punctuating the year, as well as functioning as a source of rudimentary education for many villagers. It is a fundamental element of life. Ebihara succinctly and I think quite brilliantly summarizes the significance of spirituality for the Khmer in Svai when she says that the folk religion does a lot to supplement Buddhism. Quote, Buddhism can explain transcendental questions, such as one's general existence in this life and the next, but the folk religion can give reasons for and means of coping with the more immediate and incidental, yet nonetheless pressing, problems and fortunes of one's present existence. The accumulation of Buddhist merit may enable a better rebirth in the next life, but in the meantime, there may be problems such as drought, illness, or unrequited love in this life that needs attention, and these worries can be relieved by recourse to the folk religion. Another aspect of life that Ebihara highlights extensively is the relationship between the people who all live in the village, and she says that many of the 800 that live over the three hamlets of Svai are usually, in some way, related to one another, whether by blood or by marriage. And if not, they are not that far off of a relative who is. So, most people know each other, And if not, they at least know someone who knows someone you know. There is quite a close-knit community atmosphere. Because of this, she says that villagers generally distrust and fear places that they have no kinsmen or friends. That it would be unlikely that a person would move into a community unless they were marrying someone in that community, or already related to someone within it. That's an interesting idea to plant a flag in for now, as we will return to this dynamic between the two groups of Khmer, those Cambodians ejected from the cities, and those already in the rural hamlets, when the Khmer Rouge take control of Cambodia. The sense of animosity that can sometimes be found in accounts of the so-called New People, or April 17 people, who were forced to integrate into these villages, often relate experiences where the old, or base people, as they were called, were worse to them because of this status difference. And it may be in some ways tied to this cultural facet of distrust of outsiders, but also ramped up by Khmer Rouge ideology and the living conditions in democratic Kampuchea. That idea shouldn't exactly be conflated with the idea that these villagers just hate outsiders, and you'll see differing accounts of the treatment of new people by base people in the Khmer Rouge period. But you could say that there was at least a sense of anxiety inbuilt into the rural culture about people who they didn't know. Leaving aside the eventual dynamic between the designated groups in democratic Kampuchea, the old people and the new people, when we're talking about life in Sveh, it's quite easy to see that family and the family unit was a fundamental aspect of life as well. Ebihara says that the strongest and most enduring relationships in village life are found in the bonds between husband and wife, sibling and sibling, and especially parent and child. According to both legal codes and cultural norms, family members should, and usually do, offer one another daily support, loyalty, consideration, as well as special assistance in times of trouble. In addition, the nuclear family is often the basic economic unit of production and consumption, which cooperate in subsistence activities and shares produce, income, and property. The fundamental activity of life, subsistence agriculture, is taken part in by the whole family, and that unit can therefore be seen as a condition of living a good life. Men and women will marry out of love, but also out of necessity or convenience, and these relationships vary from couple to couple. The legal code places man as the chief of the family, and Buddhist doctrine also assigns a similar position. But that's not to say that women are powerless or treated poorly. In fact, women are afforded many rights and privileges, and Ebihara says that at this time, the relative positions of male and female, husband and wife, were virtually equal in everyday life. There is a basic kind of egalitarianism between families within the village too, particularly in this village, where almost everyone was ethnic Khmer, the great majority were rice growers, Buddhists, and the status differences between members of the community was minimal. Ebihara said that a common saying of the villagers in Sveh was, "We are all people of the rice fields. We are all poor. We are all just the same." And that there was not too much special formality or etiquette needed between people, beside that which is afforded to older people or monks. Because Buddhist teachings emphasize that worldly possessions are not as important as spiritual worth, the differences in wealth are not particularly conspicuous in village life, but also because these differences are relatively minimal anyway. Those sayings, however, like, "We are all poor," well, that's not to give the impression that there is a glorification of poverty or a cult of poverty, as the phrase Ebihara uses. Rather, much like the Buddhist teachings about alcohol consumption can be turned away from quite easily if the time's right, so too are ideas about wealth. Just because you're a Buddhist doesn't mean that you might not yearn for a new dress or shirt and save up to buy one. Indeed, the accumulation of wealth and achievement of upward social mobility are traits that are admired by the villagers in Sveh. even vaguely envied or desired. So, again, when we eventually discuss the so-called base or old people as designated by the Khmer Rouge, we're not talking about these people who were somehow already married to the idea of not having any property or thinking that money should have been abolished. You get the sense that the villagers of Svay live the life that they have without too much stress or envy, but realize their status as well, which is perhaps where the Buddhist ideas of merit accumulation, as opposed to gaining wealth, would be of comfort in your life, particularly if the avenues upward were limited. The main criteria in Svay for evaluating wealth is the amount of rice fields that someone possesses, because this not only relates to how much food they have, but to how much surplus they might sell, which can then provide them with a nicer house, more clothing, jewelry, or education, if it were available. Food resources are supplemented by small kitchen gardens, fishing, and limited gathering of plants. Cash income, necessary to purchase items not produced at home, must also be augmented by various non-agricultural activities, such as making palm sugar, raising pigs and chickens for sale, or finding temporary employment of different kinds. For most of the villagers, this kind of subsistence lifestyle does involve a degree of worry and effort in order to make ends meet, a way of life that is surely contrasted to the life of affluent urbanites. Unlike the people in the cities, the people in a village like Svay also don't have access to banks. So, any surplus cash that they may end up saving is usually invested into things like jewelry, gold or jewels. These items can be sold quite quickly if necessary and act as a kind of savings. So, what can we learn from this study of the village called Svay? What kind of ideas do we get about just living as a Khmer in Cambodia? This being the life that if you were born in Cambodia during this time, you would be overwhelmingly likely to live. Well, as you can see in those descriptions as earthy or elemental, as well as some of those ideas about aspects of this lifestyle being very old and likely maintained for hundreds of years at this point, well, they do seem to ring true. This life surely seems a little tough by many of our modern standards. And there's a reason that the idea of, or the connotations of the word peasant, are generally negative, or at least something that we wouldn't hope for. But we can also see elements of life for the average Khmer in the countryside as being quite harmonious with nature, deeply in tune with the earth, in a way that many of us might admire, or sometimes indeed yearn for. We can see a community which is focused on a goal, grow enough food, and the role that deep ties to family and community plays in this kind of society. But we shouldn't just think of the Khmer here as downtrodden and bemoaning this character of their lives, in the same way that you have to work to earn money to live in your house or buy your food, as well as finding the time to do the things you like and see the people you love. In this way, our lives are quite similar. We work, we save, we eat, we spend time with friends and family, we laugh, suffer, wait for holidays or festivals, and relax when possible. We do tend to do this day after day, year after year. We need to imagine life in the countryside involving life. Children playing games together and teasing. Young men and women, when they weren't completing chores, sitting around, talking, joking, flirting, playing music, gossiping, singing popular songs. A woman visiting a medicine man to collect a remedy for a loved one. Or a young man worrying that he might have drank too much and embarrassed himself at a recent wedding. When we eventually come to the point in our story when a civil war will take grip of Cambodia and more of this countryside will fall into the hands of the Khmer Rouge, as we arrive at that point and begin discussing the stark difference in life that is seen between those living in the cities, those in the countryside, we need to remember that life in the countryside was not aimed against those in the city. It was not lived by automatons who worshipped poverty and who would be content to wear one outfit of black pajamas and toil for 16 hours a day. The Khmer Rouge will ruin this world, as well as the world of the urban classes, warping and dementing a world based on family and community to one in which the family was smashed and broken, and the spirituality which supported their lifestyle amputated, and even the ability to grow enough food for yourself and your family taken away. But that is later in the story. And with all that I've said about life in the countryside in the 20s and 30s, I feel as though I've painted a pretty rosy picture. And we should still note that life in rural Cambodia was tough, was poor, and it was lacking in things like education, modern medicine, and opportunities of upward mobility. There certainly was a big difference between the lives of the Khmer in a village like Sphae and those in Phnom Penh. In this period, when we do approach the 1930s, some of the most easily discernible differences would be basic elements of what I guess you would call modernity. Running water, electricity, also clearly just in the kind of life a farmer lives to that of, let's say, a small businessman. Remember, this is also the time when Phnom Penh was starting to become quite noticeably different to the rest of the country, and in a sense, becoming quite un-Khmer. Ebihara states that, to some villagers, especially the older ones, who enjoy the calm security of the countryside, Phnom Penh seems to be a welter of noise, confusion, crowding, unsavory characters, immorality, danger, and expense. An experience to be endured only when absolutely necessary. Some people who have been there bring back stories of immodest women, attempted or accomplished thievery, physical violence, and other lurid accounts or varied complaints. But for other villagers, especially the younger generation, Phnom Penh is the epitome of excitement, sophistication, and glamour, the symbol of wealth and escape from peasant life. They visit the city eagerly and describe its sights with glowing eyes. It's at this point in the story, in the mid-20s and into the early 30s, that you may recall Salasar grows up. And as we discussed at the beginning of the last episode, he will be sent from his family's village in Prex Bao, one that would surely have many of the characteristics of Sphae, and he will go to live with his cousin Miak and his older brother in this completely new environment in the city. A journey he will make not on a horse and cart, as would have been the case for hundreds of years previously, but instead on a steam bus, which is kind of what it sounds like. Imagine a steam train, like Thomas the Tank Engine, but it's got wheels on. It all has this kind of quite useful metaphorical quality. It's like hopping on a vehicle of modernity, traveling on a modern road, to the symbol of modernity in Cambodia, the increasingly un-Khmer city of Phnom Penh. Phnom Penh like in this time? What can we imagine the boy who would become Pol Pot seeing as he sat upon this steam bus, arriving into Cambodia's modern city? David Chandler, in his biography of the eventual Khmer Rouge leader, would say that Phnom Penh in the 1930s was a sun-drenched town, a rectangular city running north to south along the western bank of the Tonle Sap River, which flowed into the Mekong. Many public buildings, such as the post office, the library, and the railroad station, were reminiscent of their counterparts in provincial France. So were the tree-lined avenues, radiating from the public gardens to the north, and shaded promenades along the river. The young boy from Prex Bao would have seen the centre of Phnom Penh containing a bustling commercial quarter of Chinese shops, warehouses, eating stalls and markets. To the west, parallel to the river, ran shaded streets and boulevards lined with stucco-covered villas of French civil servants, Chinese businessmen, and the French-educated Cambodian elite. At the northern edge of the city, the small hill that gave the city's name was crowned with Wat Phnom and several Buddhist reliquaries. This area was landscaped by the French into a 25-acre park with a small zoo, a floral clock, some statues, and several cafes. He goes on to say that in 1936, roughly half of the 100,000 people who lived in Phnom Penh were immigrant Chinese and Vietnamese, who dominated the commercial sector. Its 45,000 Cambodians lived around the royal palace as monks in the monasteries or as bureaucrats, farmers, artisans, and petty traders in the southern and western sectors of the city. The city was laid out with distinct quarters. The French quarter in the north around Wat Phnom, the Chinese in the commercial area around the centre, and the Khmers in the Cambodian village in the southern sector. The Vietnamese sector visible to the north of the French. Philip Short, in his biography of Pol Pot, says that the few hundred French families formed a tiny, if highly visible, microcosm who put their stamp on what passed for the cultural and intellectual life of the city, its pavement cafes, tree-lined boulevards, and colonial Mediterranean-style buildings. The result was a cosmopolitan, contradictory place, languid, yet bustling, a hodgepodge of conflicting styles. End quote. As we touched on briefly at the introduction to the last episode, Sa had been sent by his relatively well-off family from the village in Kampong Tom to Phnom Penh to live with his relatives who were in the city. It's worth just revisiting this dynamic and the reasons why Sa was afforded this opportunity, particularly because all of this royal stuff can be a little bit confusing, but it is still fairly relevant to the story. So, Sa's auntie Cheng, that's Loth, his father's sister, was given a post in the household of King Norodom. That's the king who brought the French into Cambodia. Then, in around about the time of Sa's birth in 1925, Cheng's daughter Miek was chosen to be a royal concubine for Monivong, the son of King Sisawat. At this time in the story, so far, we've seen Norodom lose health and die, and then King Sisawat take over. He rules from 1904 until he dies in 1927. Monivong will take the throne that year, but by then, Miek will have already bore him a son. When Monivong becomes king, she is appointed to be the head of the royal bedchamber. So, Saloth, Sa's cousin, is tied quite directly to the royal family. Like, if you get out a couple of family trees and put them pretty close together, then Saloth Sa really isn't all that far away from another extremely important character in this story, Norodom Sihanouk, who is Monivong's grandson, and he is born just 3 years earlier than Sa, in 1922. As we see some of these patronage networks at work, naturally, the connection to the royals helps to secure Sa's older brother Suong with a job as a palace officer. Soon after this, Miek, head of the royal bedchamber, summons Sa's elder sister, Ro-ung, who was 16 at the time, to join the royal harem. She will also become one of King Monivong's favourites, and will remain at his side until he dies later in our story in 1941. Again, the fairly close connection of the Sa family to the royal one is not hugely uncommon in Cambodia. The king may have hundreds of wives and concubines, but it is quite fascinating that for someone who will eventually have such a remarkably anti-royalist and anti-elitist career, well, he certainly grows up in quite close proximity to it. Quite close proximity, actually. In one of the many fascinating aspects of Philip Short's biography, he describes the visits of Tsar to the royal palace, and how they may not have been just to go visit his sister or his cousin. Quote, "There may have been another reason why Tsar's visits to the palace remained engraved on his memory. The harem of a Cambodian king in the 1930s was awash with repressed sexuality. As well as his official wives, King Monivong had innumerable concubines and serving girls, most of them in their teens or early 20s. Monivong was elderly and not in good health. Necessarily, most of these young women were physically unsatisfied. At 15, Tsar was still regarded as a child, young enough to be allowed into the women's quarters. Decades later, two of the palace women, living out their old age on French government stipends in Paris, remembered little Tsar, who used to come to visit them wearing his school uniform, a loose white shirt with baggy trousers and wooden shoes. The young women would gather around, teasing him. Then they would loosen his waistband and fondle his genitals, masturbating him to a climax. He was never allowed to have intercourse with them, but in the frustrated hothouse world of the royal pleasure house, it apparently afforded the women a vicarious satisfaction." End quote. The 15-year-old Tsar in 1940 had been living in Phnom Penh for around 6 years. He had already finished his early stint at the Buddhist monastery Wat Bathom Vadai, a period in which the monks taught him a spirit of detachment, something Short contends is impossible to know if it really made an impression on him at this crucial formative age of 10 years old, but he contends that the later political ideas of Pol Pot might be linked to these messages of severing personal ties and the suppression of individuality. He was then sent to one of the rare French primary schools in the city, the École Michel, presumably named after the Catholic priest who we met in the last episode, the friend of King Duang, who facilitated Henri Mouhot's famous visit to the country in the 1860s. We are going to return to Tsar's education and the years which follow it in later episodes, but it is worth mentioning here some of the memories that his contemporaries and relatives had of him at these times, as an amusing companion, someone who loved to laugh, an adorable child who wouldn't hurt a chicken, a boy who enjoyed playing football and making a joke. Throughout the 1920s and early 30s, many of the future leaders of the Khmer Rouge will be born and raised. Yang Seri, Khieu Samphan, Khieu Thirit, Khoi Tuan, Tha Mok, Nun Che, Son Sen, and Vaughn Vet, amongst others. I think what is more important than discussing the very early years of these people's lives is discussing the context in which they grew up. As the scope of this episode is really only up until the beginnings of World War II, I don't think we need to spend too much time right now discussing Pol Pot as someone in his early teens, apart from saying that at this point in his life, there is nothing particularly apparent in his circumstances or personality that would make someone wonder if he would grow up to be one of the 20th century's most terrible figures. And this can be a little scary. We often hope that people capable of what we usually term evil are born that way, or have some glint in their eye that would indicate that they wanted to knowingly do evil things. But from all accounts, he was a kind, normal, fun-loving kid. He came from what seems like a supportive and relatively well-off family. He was insulated from poverty and did not suffer the conditions of life that he would eventually impose on the Cambodian population at large. He was religiously educated and then given the rare opportunity of Western education as well, there is certainly no apparent extreme psychological distress that we can see in his early life. Nothing to indicate he was a psychopath, which begs the question. If the eventual leader of the Khmer Rouge was not always evil, whatever that might mean, when and how did he, and those around him, become capable of what they would be eventually responsible for? Perhaps these kinds of binary ideas of good and evil are not particularly useful, but some confluence of forces will eventually lead him and the rest of the Communist Party of Kampuchea toward the near destruction of a nation. That is not to say that we don't see hints, or at least partial hints, or potential explanations for what he will do later. And we will certainly see more and more as this young man grows up, and other actions or influences come into sharper focus. But for now, he was just a boy. What I think can be deduced from this period of his life, and what we could feasibly impart to some of the other eventual leaders of the movement, is that some of the structures and influences on Cambodia during this period will eventually manifest into certain political movements. We've already talked about some of these influences in the series so far. The transformation of the Khmer Empire into Cambodia. The less than amicable relationship between Vietnam and Cambodia. The imposition of colonial control of Cambodia from the distinct political entity that France had become. And now we can look at another. One of the most important themes of this period in question, the mid-1920s, right up until the beginning of World War II, is that political energy that we've been talking about. That fuel for political action and consciousness. The beginnings, or even discovery, of nationalism in Cambodia. This is important because the character of their nationalism will be influenced by some of these other larger forces and the historical circumstances that had determined the fate of Cambodia in the early 20th century. In 1937, 30-year-old Son Ngoc Tan was returning to his place of work near the Royal Palace in Phnom Penh. He'd just walked uptown to see the building which had just been finished in the central area of the city. It had been designed by a French architect, Jean Dubois, and Tan had found the huge central market building stunning. With its bright yellow paint, a massive central dome more than 25 meters high, and the four large arched arms which extend out from it diagonally, mimicking the four rivers which converged on Phnom Penh. It was another testament to the city's growing modernity. The central market was, at the time, Asia's largest. Tan was on his way back to the Buddhist Institute, which you could think of kind of like the government-backed office of Buddhism in Cambodia. It was founded in 1930 by the French and acted as a repository for Cambodian religious texts and a meeting place for Buddhist intellectuals, most of them monks or former monks. This building was located just near the Royal Palace, and the frequency which he came to the area may have meant that Salazar's relatives, like Miek or Suong, would have been able to recognize him in the same way you notice the same people you might see on a regular basis without actually knowing who they are. Son Ngoc Tan was deputy director of the Buddhist Institute, a post he had been given a few years earlier. This was a fairly prestigious position and reflected the career that he had been building for himself. Tan was originally from Cochin, China, and a member of the Khmer Krom, an ethnic minority in the region composed of the Khmer who remained there after the region was conquered by the Vietnamese in the 17th century. Now part of colonial France and benefiting from French citizenship, unlike the Cambodians who were technically a protectorate rather than a colony, as this region was, he got a primary education in Saigon and then was able to move to France to obtain higher education in Montpellier and Paris. He completed a teaching diploma there and studied law for a year at the University of Paris. He returned to Indochina in 1933. He briefly worked as a clerk at the Phnom Penh Library before becoming a magistrate in the western province of Pursat, working his way up to a public prosecutor back in Phnom Penh. He was then given this post at the Buddhist Institute. It was during his time here that he met Pak Cho Un, another member of the emerging intellectual Cambodian elite. Cho Un had been in World War I and served as a translator on the Western Front. These men represented a slight change in the way Cambodia was being run by the French. In a move that saw marginal increases in Khmer participation in the administration of the country, it also highlighted the state of education at this point. The fact that Than had a tertiary education was exceedingly rare. In fact, 1930 had seen only the first group of Cambodian students to finish secondary school, or the French version of latter secondary school, known as a lycée. In a somewhat damning indictment of French efforts to provide education to the Khmer, these students that graduated hadn't even done so in Cambodia, instead at a school in Saigon. The first school of this kind in Cambodia, which caters to like 15 to 18 year olds, was the Lycée Sisawat, and it was founded in 1936. It was astonishing that for probably more than half a million school-aged children, no more than a few thousand had access to even the basics of primary education, and even less to anything higher than that. Yet there were those that were beginning to access it, and one of the focal points for the group that would eventually be educated was this Buddhist Institute, particularly after Than and Cho Un were able to attain royal patronage for a new Khmer language newspaper, the first of its kind in history. They had originally asked Prince Sisawat Monireth, King Monivong's oldest son, for help in funding the project, but he rebuffed them, saying briskly that in his opinion, education was a waste of time, because better educated Khmer would be difficult to govern. So, instead, they turned to Monireth's brother-in-law, Prince Norodom Suramirit, who agreed to act as a patron and would remain close friends with Than and Chuan for years, especially after his son, the young Norodom Sihanouk, would become king in 1941. The name of the newspaper was Nagaravarta, which in Pali translates to something close to Our Land of the Temple, or basically a reference to Angkor Wat. The paper was founded in 1936, the same year that the first high school was opened in Phnom Penh, and would eventually find much of its readership in the graduates of that school, not far from the Royal Palace, of whom some we mentioned in that list of leaders of the Khmer Rouge that were born in the 1920s and early 30s. Other readers, as suggested by David Chandler, would have included the pair that would have been recognizing Than as he went to work that day, Salat Sa's cousin Miek and brother Suan. And what would readers of this paper get out of it? Well, it reported the activities of Cambodia's elite, reprinted the texts of regulations and decrees, and in editorials, it urged Cambodians to awaken. Chandler says that the editorial strand of Nagaravarta was pro-Cambodian without being anti-French. It objected to Vietnamese domination of the Cambodian civil service, Chinese domination of commerce, and the shortage of suitable employment for educated Khmer. Ben Kiernan differs slightly from Chandler when he says that the newspaper was an expression of subdued anti-colonialism. It publicized the occasional overt example of French oppression, which he says was daring enough at that time. But he relays another historian, Michael Vickery, who says that the paper was strictly shopkeeper capitalist and nationalist, again emphasizing the urging of Khmers to go into business in order to break the monopoly of the other ethnic groups and thereby strengthen the position of the Khmer within their own country. Editorials also condemned the usury of Chinese rural merchants, French delays in modernizing the education system, the shortage of credit for Cambodian farmers, and the low pay of Cambodian civil servants. Chandler also emphasizes that, quote, the paper also sought to increase the distance between Cambodian history and aspirations, on the one hand, and those of the Vietnamese, on the other. He suggests that the paper eventually found an anti-Vietnamese tone. One editorial even went so far as to compare Hitler's territorial aggrandizement in Europe to that of Vietnam in 19th century Cambodia. So while Hitler began taking over parts of Europe toward the end of the 1930s, the editors of the paper compared that to how Vietnam had taken over Cambodia in the tumultuous period before the French Protectorate. Eventually, the paper would be read by more than just those who bought the 5,000 or so copies that were being printed of each issue. Nagaravarta provides us with a great example of the stirrings of Cambodian nationalism, and for a few reasons. We can see this even in the name. Land of our temple, Angkor Wat, this espouses the glory of Cambodia's past, something that the French had been instrumental in bringing back to the Cambodian psyche, and a result of the love affair between French scholars and Cambodia's medieval past that had been started by Henry Mouhot in the 1860s. Chandler states in Brother Number One that, quote, "French scholarship gave the Cambodians a prestigious history that as a colonized people, they were not prepared to handle. The French stressed the contrast between the glories of Angkorian Empire and what they perceived as its decline in the 19th and 20th centuries, between Angkorian mastery and the protectorate's dependence, between the grandeur of Angkor's kings and the impotence of those like Monuvong, who were selected by the French to govern colonial Cambodia. These contradictions produced a crisis of identity among educated Khmer in the 1930s and 40s that acted as a catalyst for Cambodian nationalism." End quote. He also invites us to imagine a young Saloth Sar visiting the museum that wasn't far from his home, seeing the relics of his people's past glory, juxtaposed with its relatively impotent present state. The difference between the god kings who built immense temple mountains to the middle-aged, powerless monarch who often dressed in French military uniform and who really only ruled over the few acres of his palace compound. These representations of the past are really important for our story, and part of the reason why we have traced the explanation of the Khmer Rouge Revolution all the way back to the days of Angkor. Benedict Anderson wrote in his famous book, Imagined Communities, about this idea of nationalism. He said that a nation is made up of a vast majority of people who will never ever meet each other, see each other, or hear each other. Yet, I mean, for someone like me, I'm still going to say, yes, I'm an Australian. And when I use that word, I'm vaguely conceiving of a huge amount of people who are also Australian, and we compose a people who have vaguely similar ideas about what it means to be Australian. He says this relies on an imagined community in order to achieve this, as well as the attendant features of a nation and nationalism. We have a shared identity. He argued that this development is nearly always related to the growth of print media and to amplified education, emphasizing a community's individuality, expressed in part by representations of its past, meaning that a rise in education, accompanied by the spread of particularly print media, will be a key ingredient in establishing this imagined community, and therefore the idea of a nation, and thus, nationalism. If we liken this to the metaphor of using coal power for electricity, and how this is a basic form of getting energy, well, it's basically saying that even though it's pretty easy to get the coal out of the ground and burn it, you still need a few basic tools and know-how to get that done. Like, I can't just go out, can I, and do that. I'd at least need a shovel, and if I don't have a shovel, I'd have to be able to build one. I'd also need an idea about something to burn the coal in. So even this political energy that is aimed at some of the more base human instincts, like protecting your land, xenophobia, my way is better than your way, even this requires some tools and effort. You would also need to be educated enough, or at least have an educated group within your movement, that was able to identify the nationalist identity that was going to be spread. You've got to know where the coal is in this metaphorical ground, and you need a conceptual shovel or pickaxe to get it out. So what is the nationalism that is being dug out here? And how does an essential part of this process, like Nagaravarta, contribute to that nationalist energy? So the coal that's being dug out of the ground here, this Cambodian identity, like other nationalist movements, it must set itself up as what it's not. In this case, it's not Vietnamese, and may even be in opposition to that identity. This plays into other notions of the hereditary enemy discussion we've had about the Khmer and the Vietnamese. Don't spill the master's tea, and all of that. As we mentioned, the Vietnamese encroachment and treatment of Cambodians was likened to the actions of Hitler that was occurring in the late 1930s. This anti-Vietnamese sentiment, and its long-standing place within Cambodian nationalism, can surely be seen as one of the precursors to the decision of the Communist Party of Kampuchea to eventually commit genocide against the remaining Vietnamese during their time in power. The paper was also bemoaning the status of the Khmer at this time, and this comes from the way that the French had been running the country. Prominent positions occupied by Chinese or Vietnamese, the lack of education for Cambodians, as well as the lack of opportunities for the rare few who actually had obtained education. The idea that the Khmer needed to wake up and take back what was theirs. All of this can be related back to Benedict Anderson's idea of nationalism emphasizing a community's uniqueness and individuality, particularly in reference to that community's past. Cambodians, particularly this new educated elite, were seeing representations of their past as those that had conquered most of mainland Southeast Asia. Their ancestors had built Angkor. How could they be in this position now? Their nationalism was constructed at a time when there was a sense of inferiority, or at least an acknowledgement that they were not doing as well as they should be, and that this needed to change. Just like how French nationalism, born during the French Revolution, was moulded by the context of the day, the fear of outside invasion, the need to safeguard the revolution, and the abolition of the monarchy, Cambodian nationalism will be born in a time that imbues it with certain characteristics, and these will be absorbed during a crucial time in Cambodian history, because sooner rather than later, they will become independent of France, and required to cope with the problems that that will produce. Now, the French, at this point, any interaction between them and this new educated elite was not done toward a cordial and eventual handover. The French had no plans of leaving Indochina, and the wars they eventually fight over it are testament to that. While the French in Cambodia were, at this time, I would say, far from as bad as a colonial power can be, see Belgium in the Congo for an example in that direction, they were, well, as we said earlier, negligent. That's probably the best word I can think of. And considering what is, in the late 1930s, just around the corner for the French, in the shape of a Nazi blitzkrieg, well, Chandler, again in A History of Cambodia, says that, quote, "There were no moves in Cambodia, for example, to widen the electorate, to introduce representative government, or to train Cambodians in a systematic way to replace Frenchmen in the administration." He goes on to point out the ironic events of 1939, when elaborate ceremonies were sponsored in Phnom Penh to honour the 150th anniversary of the French Revolution. Remember that one? Perhaps some of the ideas about this revolution, which was of course taught in any school that had been bothered to be set up in Cambodia, and taught in French of course, would not be lost on some of the Cambodian students who would grow up in this period. But before it is their turn to try out their ideas on how to run this country, someone like Son Ngoc Thanh, who can almost be considered one of the founders of Cambodian nationalism, he will have a significant role to play when we return to Cambodia and see how these developments play out during the chaotic events of the Second World War and its aftermath. This is when our discussion must turn again to events happening not only elsewhere in the world, but also in neighbouring Vietnam. The French control of that country is not anywhere near as peaceful and easy as it is in Cambodia. In Cambodia, a new intellectual elite is only just discovering that metaphorical coal and the ways to dig it up and burn it to create a new political energy. Well, a group within Vietnam is toying with something far more advanced. A new, globally focused kind of revolutionary energy. Communism. An energy which requires much more theoretical nuance and technological savvy to be able to harness properly. perhaps comparable to nuclear energy, as opposed to simply burning coal, and one that may possess similarly disastrous effects if not handled with the utmost care. And it is at this point that we must turn this series toward a discussion of a theme that will become fundamental. We need to talk about communism and its roots and the eventuality of the Cold War. To do so, we will need to go pretty far back to the Industrial Revolution, which we will pick up in the next episode as we see how the world had splintered during Cambodia's stunted development in the 20th century under the so-called French protectorate. We will see how the world coped with the destruction of World War I and how it laid the tracks for the second, and how some of the nationalist themes in Nagaravada will collide with the downfall of France and the rise of Japanese imperialism. Not to mention how a generation of young Cambodians, with members like Salot Sar, will react to these changes too. But here, at the end of the episode, I just want to say thank you again for listening. We've come a long way once again, but we've finally been able to look at Cambodia in a modern context and explored what it was like for Cambodians during this period. The 20th century is, well, it is a century of death, and we will soon arrive at Cambodia's contribution to that century. If you have listened all the way to the end of this episode, I'm really glad. And if you've been listening to this series since it started, thank you for your patience. While you're here, or if you haven't already, please consider leaving a rating or review wherever you might be listening to this show. Feel free to engage with the content on the website at www.shadowsofutopia.com, which now includes a full list of sources used in the show. Or you can also check out the Twitter account I've set up at Khmer Utopia. You could also contact me via email directly at shadowsofutopiapodcast@gmail.com. So with all that being said, once again, this is Lachlan Peters. Until next time, thank you for listening.